25 years ago this month, an unlikely revolution began on television. An unblinking eye focused on the House of Representatives, gavel to gavel. Since then, C-SPAN, the cable satellite public affairs network, has expanded to cover the Senate, political conventions, debates, news conferences, and events of many kinds, but the approach has stayed the same. Gavel to gavel, unfiltered, no fancy graphics, and no stars. Well, one star, maybe, but a reluctant one. 10 years after he founded C-SPAN, Brian Lamb launched Book Notes, a weekly interview program that features nonfiction authors. The fourth collection of interviews from the program is just out. It's titled Book Notes on American Character, People, Politics, and Conflict in American History. Later in the program, we'll try to explain the cause and meaning of the record trade deficit of $43 billion in January. But first, Brian Lamb, Book Notes, and C-SPAN. If you have questions for Brian Lamb about the program or about C-SPAN, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And Brian Lamb is with us here in Studio 3A. It's great to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil. And I should say right out of the box, congratulations on your first 25 years with NPR.
Well, thank you, Brian. This collection from Book Notes focuses on American character. Two interviews you open with are certainly very different. Let's listen to part of the 2002 interview of Ann Coulter on her book, Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right.
One of the biggest pieces of propaganda, one of the biggest lies that is always made, liberals viciously attack conservatives, compare them to Down syndrome children, wish them dead of cholesterol-induced heart attacks, accuse them of trying to bring back slavery, and then they say, oh, well, both sides do it. No.
Well, let's compare that to the next interview of the book, Michael Moore on his book, Dude, Where's My Country?
I mean, Karl Rove and all these guys in the White House, man, my hat's off to them because they know how to... The thing when you get into serial lying like they have, I honestly believe if you hook them up to a lie detector test, they'd pass it because they've told it so often and so well, they believe it themselves.
Brian Lamb, it's no coincidence that you started with these two very different interviews.
True, because when you do a book on American character, and these are just selected interviews that we've done over the last 15 years, you can't help but note that in this day and age, there's a great divide in the United States. And a lot of our callers, I'm sure you've heard the same thing here, call and say, why are we so ugly with each other, and what's going on? And frankly, the reason they're doing it is it's nothing new. As a matter of fact, it's probably not nearly as divided and as angry as it was 150 years ago or even 100 years ago. The good news today is that we have so many outlets to express it that if you don't like what you see mostly, by the way, I think on the cable channels that have these, Crossfire, Hannity and Combs type programs, mm-hmm. they've developed into, yelling at your sidekick fest, and but you have a choice, but we're not any more divided today than we have been many times in the past.
And one of the things that you have consistently focused on through the years is history in general, American history in particular.
Yes, because a lot of people don't know much about it, including myself. I mean, one of the things that got me into this program was that I didn't know much about history. I started seeing there was so much of an advantage to reading a book instead of just listening or watching television. And when you watch commercial television, your interviews that you saw were maybe 6 minutes on the Today Show. Nothing wrong with Today Show doing 6 minutes, is there's so much more to talk about. And that's why we started Book Notes back in 89.
Well, how do you decide which books to choose?
Same way you decide who to have on your program. You're constantly looking for, first of all, books that you're not going to see on every other program. Because there are so many shows now that if you're not careful, you'll find people going from show to show to show, and you won't have much of an alternative. Also, I love to do books that you'll never see anywhere on television. You might hear them on radio. You have here on this program a lot of opportunity, like the book about the Supreme Court clerk John Knox. It got so little attention, but it's so interesting if you're aficionado of the Supreme Court, because it's the only time other than the Lazarus book, Ed Lazarus, a couple years ago, where you really had an insight from a clerk into how the Supreme Court worked. And this goes back to the 30s. And he had kept this diary and never published it, and actually was a personal failure in life. He's from Chicago. And Dennis Hutchinson, who was at the University of Chicago, had found it in the archives, brought it out, published it, and we interviewed him about this. And it was really interesting because he worked for an anti-Semitic judge years and years ago, McReynolds, and he was also a bigot and a lot of other things. But it's books like that, I think, that are unusual that you learn something.
I was just turning to a page, your interview with Alan Ebenstein about his book on Friedrich Hayek, a free market philosopher. And the conclusion of that interview, he says, there's a feeling that whatever exists now is the way things always are going to be and the way they've always been. If there's one thing we learn from history, he says, it's that the future will be completely unlike the present. We don't know how it's going to be, but we should know that it's going to be completely different. Hayek is somebody who had a really different view of the world. He tried to enunciate it, and obviously it's a view that has inspired many people. Whatever your view of Hayek is, that's an inspiring thought and a provocative one.
Well, you go back to your first question on how do you select books. I remember that one in particular because one actually, I think it was a Saturday. I picked up the New York Times, and on the op-ed page was the introduction to the 50th anniversary of the University of Chicago's publishing of The Road to Serfdom, written by Milton Friedman.
Mm-hmm.
I read it, and I'd heard of Hayek because he pops up in a lot of these books, and I thought to myself, there's a great opportunity to interview Milton Friedman, who didn't have a book at the time, and also to find out once and for all what's in Road to Serfdom, and that's how we picked that one.
It's interesting. Let me ask you a question about style. Book Notes always begins with a shot not of you, but of the guest. Your questions are brief. They are designed, it seems to me, to elucidate answers. And it seems typical of both you and C-SPAN that in this book, as in its predecessors, your questions have been edited out.
Yes. I love to ask questions. I love to learn. I'm sure you do the same thing. But we try very hard, maybe to a fault sometimes, to take us out of the equation. And so that people are watching and listening primarily to the guest on Book Notes. And it kind of works. I mean, there's no way of knowing. We don't have ratings, so you don't know how big your audience is out there. But based on anecdotal experience over the years, most people begin to appreciate the author instead of what we're doing. Although I'm always struck, and I ran some emails in the front of this book, how angry people can get with us. They think with me personally, they mm-hmm. think I'm asking a question for a reason because I'm anti the author or anti the subject matter. And it's really interesting to see how often they're just so dead wrong about it. Because I don't really care what an author says. I do care that if I know they're sitting there not telling me the whole truth, that in some way, without being offensive, we keep going back and asking the question. And it's amazing, though, what people see that's not there.
Yeah, and one of the things, the few things for which you are sometimes criticized is for not challenging authors more, for not saying, how can you possibly believe that? Or, sir, you may be wrong on the facts there.
Yes, because often the case is, the more angry you get with a guest, the more sympathetic the audience gets toward the guest, and more angry they get toward the host. And again, I've always had this very strong feeling. First of all, I don't know all the time what's right and wrong when I'm interviewing somebody. I do have a lot of confidence that the people watching are pretty smart, and if they're interested, they'll go even farther than I have in researching the answer to it. And I've had a philosophy that's developed over the last 25 years of interviewing, is that people who are angry with the hosts are often angry because they worry about that dumb guy down the street. They're not worried. They've figured it out. They've figured out what's right and wrong, and they want the guy down the street to make sure. They want me to correct it for the guy down the street because they don't think he's smart or with it. And so they're usually just – that's the only reason they're calling, because they want – the guy down the street to be as smart as they are, and they think it's my job to make them that way.
Let's get some callers on the line. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Brian Lamb, the founder and chief executive officer of C-SPAN, and his new book is Book Notes on American Character. Our first caller is Susan, who's with us from Minnetonka, Minnesota.
Yes, I was just wondering, Mr. Lamb, about the change in format that went on past year, I think, on the Washington Journal. It used to be like two opposing sides would sit and discuss an issue together. And I always liked that because I could learn about both sides of the issue. And it was more, it seemed more civilized on C-SPAN than in other locations. And then now this year, I think you had like one side of an issue talking for an hour, and then the opposing side would come following, and they wouldn't have that interchange between each other. And I just preferred the exchange. And I was wondering if what the reason was behind the change in format, or if you're thinking about going back to that side-by-side discussion instead of individual programs.
Very good question, and I unfortunately, time moves fast. I think you're missing a couple years there. We started this.
Yeah, I'm not sure when.
Yeah. It was at the end of the Clinton administration when we started. And here's the reason.
Yeah, that's what I meant, yeah.
Here's the reason. That is a call-in show, and more than anything else, we are anxious to get callers involved and not to dominate it with guests. And our philosophy, right or wrong, is that by having a single guest on, not all the time, but often, then the callers do the work of cross-examining the guest. If you have two people on, I guarantee you, as a host, I've done it many times, you will probably lessen the number of calls by two-thirds because each side thinks they have to answer each question, and therefore we have less and less callers. Our attitude is that you can find these kind of shows everywhere. You can find discussions everywhere, but you can't find on television callers everywhere. Almost nowhere else on television can you find a show devoted to the callers first and everybody else second. That's the philosophy. I know people get irritated who want the two guests on either side talking civilized about the issues, but we take a minimum of 60 calls every Washington Journal for the 3 hours, 20 calls an hour. And in the old days, we probably took, half as many calls. That's the main reason.
I always thought I learned something from a discussion like that, and I would tune to C-SPAN to become educated on both sides.
Well, thanks for the call, Susan.
Okay, well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, I can just say that we're not going to stop having two guests, but as a matter of fact, as we get into this, what's going to be a very difficult political year, we may end up doing more of that than we really want to because of this business of balance.
Let's get to Mark, and Mark is with us from Alameda, California.
Hi, Brian. I'm a huge fan of Book Notes, Book TV, and Prime Minister's Question Time, and I thought I'd make a couple of suggestions for upcoming programs. One is the J. Robert Oppenheimer Memorial for Centennial, which will be at UC Berkeley in May, and there's also going to be a Fats Waller Memorial Conference at Rutgers University also in May, which actually I will be participating in.
There you go.
Yeah.
Fats Waller. Terrific.
Yeah. That's perfect C-SPAN stuff.
Yeah, Mark, most of the people listening to this have no idea. They think Fats Waller probably was a mayor of some city back in the 20s.
Or maybe a pool player. That was Minnesota Fats. Fats Waller, of course, the great stride piano player from New York.
That's right. And sadly, he's mostly known as either an actor or a comedian. But he was one of the seminal jazz pianists. That's what we'll be talking about.
That sounds like a great fun. Thank you for your suggestion.
Thank you so much, Brian.
And thanks for the phone call, Mark.
Thank you.
We're talking with Brian Lamb about Book Notes and about C-SPAN, and we're taking your phone calls. We're going to take a short break. More of both when we come back. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email on totn@npr.org. By the way, to read excerpts from Book Notes on American Character, you can head to www.npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with C-SPAN's founder Brian Lamb about his new collection of Book Notes interviews that focus on American character. Of course, you're invited to join us. How has C-SPAN shaped your interaction with Congress and other elected officials? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Francis, who's with us from El Dorado Hills in California.
Hi, how are you? The first thing I'd just simply like to say is that many of my weekends have totally evaporated watching book TV, and I don't regret having 1 second lost.
Thanks, Francis.
It's a wonderful, wonderful thing, and if I could have it 7 days a week, which I'm sure would kill all of you and the staff, I'd even prefer that. But the only question I have or comment or suggestion is, you know, there are a lot of great American jazz musicians, especially those that are nearing shuffling off the mortal coil. I wonder if you'd ever consider biographies of any of them, the ones that are now living, like Ornette Coleman or, I guess Wayne Shorter. I mean, there's so many, but it's just a subject that one rarely hears anything about except on a jazz station. And I know that a lot of people that are serious about jazz music and its unique American quality read a lot. Whatever you have to say, I'll listen to it on the air.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Francis.
It's off the mark for us for regular series of any kind. Once in a while on Book Notes, I'll do somebody that may be in the jazz world, but it has to have some kind of a political connection. I'll give you an example. Isaac Stern, before he died, we did on Book Notes on a book that he was, when he said he was, I think he was 79 years old. And the reason was he was so involved in so many political activities, so many administrations, that it seemed to make sense. And he told stories about that. But there is a connection. For instance, Cornel West, I think one of his big heroes is John Coltrane. And that would make some sense, but it's a bit of a stretch for us.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what C-SPAN is and what its purpose is and the origins of it. And I understand that at many years ago, in fact, you were working at the Pentagon. You were in the Army, I think, then.
Navy.
And the Navy. Please excuse me. I get into trouble for that. But you were watching a demonstration. It was the 60s, a time of many demonstrations, and noticed how people reacted to the presence of television cameras.
As a matter of fact, I remember like it was yesterday. It was in 1967. It was a big march on Washington. This was around a big march on Washington. A bunch of young folks came down from a town in Volantown, Connecticut, and they, you know, marched all the way down to the Pentagon, and they found themselves camped outside the Situation Room over at the Pentagon on the first floor, and they let them in. Robert McNamara was Secretary of Defense, and he let them in, and they literally would lie down on the floor right around the entrance. And I remember the late Bill Downs, who worked for ABC, previous to that, CBS, I think, reported in World War II. And I knew Bill very well. I was working there in the Navy at the time as a liaison. And I remember the day he came to the Situation Room. He had a camera outside with all these kids on the ground. And the minute he started doing his stand-up, the kids stood up. They took their placards. They started screaming, yelling, and hollering. That night on the evening news, that's what the people saw in the audience, and it was not reality. It didn't happen that way. They were not doing that at all during the time that they were visiting. They were quite peaceful, and it looked like this big rally outside the Situation Room that kids were, placards flying, and it was dishonest.
And how did that lead you eventually to the kind of approach that you've taken on C-SPAN?
Well, it took a long time from that date forward. That was 67, and we went on the air in 79. I stumbled through the next 11, 12 years trying to find a way to get involved in this business and to change it. And what really changed was technology, because the satellites were launched for domestic use in 74. The cable industry started looking for new programming. The one thing that I did do in the C-SPAN project is pitch them an idea in 77. And a couple of fellows in the room, Bob Rosencrantz and Ken Gunner, there were about 40 cable operators there, came up afterwards and said, we want to help you do this. And there were a lot of iterations before we got to the way the organization was formed, but it ended up being a private organization with only cable industry funds to do public affairs and politics and government. And the House of Representatives at the same time was thinking about going on television, and the rest is history.
There are times, and you started out with, again, that unblinking eye on the House of Representatives, and I think that's the classic image most of us have as C-SPAN, but there certainly would have been opportunities. A private organization, you could have changed it, it changed its character, made it a news organization, made it CNN or MSNBC or Fox, whatever it is you wanted. You've decided to keep it that same approach. Why?
Well, if you notice, nobody has competed with us since we started, which means one thing. There's no money to be made off of it. And
we in public radio feel much the same way.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. So often people say, why aren't you like the rest? And I say, hey, think about it. Think what this is all about. It's all about the bottom line in commercial television and radio. And we were able, with our cable industry leaders who said, go ahead and do this, do it in a nonprofit way, to change the economics of it. That's the only reason we're able to do this. And I think there's a role for it. And it's clear after the last 25 years that CNN was founded 18 months after us, Fox and MSNBC and CNBC many years after that, we're going to probably be the only one that does this because you can't make money out of it. And it costs a lot of money. It's not outrageous in our society. It's about $40 million a year. But no one else wants to go into this kind of business because of what I've just said.
There is now, of course, not only just C-SPAN, but C-SPAN 1, 2, 3. There is a FM radio station here in the city of Washington, D.C. that's on satellite radio stations that's available around the country. I think you have 10 websites as well.
Right.
So this idea is expanding, and not just in this country.
True. We don't have a great audience overseas. WorldNet that was created by USIA picks us up from time to time, like they do most American media outlets.
Yeah, but other broadcasters abroad have copied you.
Although it's a very rocky road. We've already seen in the last 10 years, we've cooperated with them for 10 years, the Japanese put a network up and then shut it down. No interest. They couldn't keep it sustained. The best in the world is Canada. Canada was a leader in a number of ways. They started televising their House of Representatives on cable a year before we did in this country. And then they expanded much after we started a full-time 24-hour network, where they operate a 24-hour network up there for a small country of just over 30 million people. But you don't have a lot of them in the world. You have a parliamentary network in Great Britain. The French have a small network they've started. The Germans do a little bit. But don't look for it as you travel around the world, because it doesn't exist, certainly in a nonprofit, private form. Often the government started, but those are not necessarily to be trusted for a lot of reasons. When the governments can control your media outlets, you're going to see their view of it, not what really goes on.
Let's get some more callers on the line. This is Evan, who's with us from Berkeley, California.
Oh, Neil, it's so great to be on your show.
Thank you.
So much respect for this forum and forums such as C-SPAN. My question is, how, since I'm a fairly young person, I don't really remember before C-SPAN, and I would like to know how the cameras have affected Congress, how the congressmen have changed in the face of the camera. And I'd also like to say Howard Stern rules in F the FCC.
You have the same problem we do, don't you?
We do.
Yeah. He did. They always do a nice job up to a certain point.
Up to a certain point.
And they do, by the way, display that they are intelligent, but it's... they waste all of our time with this nonsense.
Now, let's get another caller on the line then. This is Robert, and Robert's with us from Fountain, Florida.
Oh, hi. Brian Lamb, such a great opportunity. My question is simply that the House and Senate, the gavel to gavel, seems like that should be available for free to every citizen without having to be hooked up to some digital system or something. When I was in Alaska, they had some kind of deal where it was sent, C-SPAN as well as several of the other significant cable things are paid for by the state of Alaska and broadcast through some sort of relay system, so that everybody in the state, no matter whether if they don't have anything but a set of rabbit ears, could see the House and the Senate on gavel to gavel on C-SPAN. Is there any movement afoot to make a real public access for free for, especially the House and Senate parts of C-SPAN?
The answer to that is no. However, you can see the House and the Senate on our websites free if you have that. You can see the streaming video, listen to the audio, which is, again...
All those things are money things that you have to... I mean, people that just... You know what I mean? In Alaska, all you have to have is a set of rabbit ears. You don't have to own a computer or subscribe to some company or go through a thing. And these people, all, I was kind of curious, too. These people are all, since they're all making money off, a lot of people would subscribe and get digital satellite dishes, I would, just to be able to see what's on C-SPAN. And it seems like that ought to be available, kind of like what Alaska does, or like you said, FM radio up there in D.C. That sounds great, where anybody could be able to hear their House and Senate. You know what I mean? It seems like that should be available to anybody just for free.
Yeah, it just isn't. And you're not going to see it happen because they don't want to devote over-the-air channels to things like this. Plus, by the way, what you're seeing in Alaska isn't free. Somebody's paying for it. It's either through your tax money or through the oil money or something. So I understand where you're coming from, but you just don't, especially in this day and age, don't look for it. We started it in 25 years ago because nobody else wanted to do it.
Robert, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Robert.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Peter. Peter's with us from Kilmarnock. Is that right, in Virginia?
Kilmarnock, Virginia. Yes, and delighted to be here. Brian, I would like to ask you, in terms of the American character and your daily involvement as a long-standing witness to it, what changes do you think you've seen in the last 25 years, if there have been any fundamental changes in the American character, and what you think might happen in the next 25 years?
Your clock's late.
My ship's clock.
We're probably wrong.
No,
you're probably right.
I think that clock on the old studio wall is accurate. Go ahead.
I will answer it this way, and this is a personal observation I'm not even sure I'm right, because in history, well, get to the point. It's money. I think since I've lived in Washington for 38 years, I've never seen so much interest in money. Just people want money, and they want more of it. And when they make a lot of it, they want to make more of it. And the scramble for money in our society is both good and bad. The good side is it creates a lot of very interesting and useful products. The downside of it is if that's all we're interested in, it seems to me to be a slippery slope. And that's my only... I mean, people who know me know I'm somewhat obsessed by that, because I think that I think it's dangerous.
Brian, one of the things you might do in that regard is follow up on people who suddenly and unexpectedly accumulate a lot of it.
Yes.
What a devastating effect that has on their lives.
I couldn't agree more.
And that would be interesting to publicize. Lottery winners are generally envied, but it's a curse because you never do enough for other people.
Well, I find it interesting. I've been around a lot of, actually, in most cases, tremendous people who have made billions, not millions, in the cable television industry, and most of them then turn around and try to give it all away.
Yeah.
And that's what's interesting, is watch what happens when you try to give money away. It's very, very hard.
Yep. Mm.
Daniel Okrent, in his book about Rockefeller Center, talked about John D. Rockefeller's inability to give the money away fast enough, faster than he was making it. Anyway, thanks for the call, Peter.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Brian Lamb is our guest. His new book is Book Notes on American Character, People, Politics, and Conflict in American History. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. For the uninitiated, in addition to watching the Senate and House on C-SPAN, most weekdays start with a program called Washington Journal. We talked a little bit about it earlier. The hosts read you highlights from the day's newspaper, invite callers, and interview a range of newsmakers for about 30 minutes each. From this morning's Washington Journal, here is C-SPAN's Rob Harlston and Ohio Democratic Representative Stephanie Tubbs-Jones taking a call from a viewer.
We'd like for you to join in the conversation. Our first call comes from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Pretty good.
You're not calling about the Steelers, are you? I'm good joking.
But no. My question actually concerns education and higher education as it pertains to jobs. And I need to actually start by thanking you. You were the first co-sponsor on Representative English's higher education bill, and we love you for it.
This program allows us to see a little of the private lives of congressmen and women, such as this juicy tidbit from Florida Republican Representative Rick Keller.
Now, you mentioned that you believe that food is addictive. Well, food may be psychologically addictive, just like I like watching the Bachelor show on ABC News every Wednesday night, but I'm not physically addicted to it, just like you would be with tobacco and nicotine.
And Brian Lamb, it never fails to astonish me that if you put people in front of a microphone, some of the things they will say.
As a matter of fact, I'm always astounded. I ask you, and I know you've seen it, you ask a simple question, and some people just start telling you their life story, and it's not a pretty picture from time to time. It's amazing what people will tell you.
Let's go to a caller. Jerry's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, Mr. Lamb, this is so much a privilege.
Hi.
I'm a real fan of Washington Journal each morning, and my question is, how do you keep your host, or what do you tell them so that they're so professional, so well-behaved, even when under attack, you know, from call to call or whatnot?
I think it's Prozac, but go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, I don't know. Some days you wonder. I mean, I have a shorter fuse than most of them because I've done it longer, and some of the attacks without any basis whatsoever. So, but I don't know. They there's no training for this. You're thrown in there with the idea that it's not about you, and when people attack you, let them attack you and keep moving. That's pretty simple. And once in a while, though, they'll go too far and they'll suggest that the sky is falling and it's your fault, and you just kind of want to suggest there might be another side to the story.
Right. It's nothing more than psychological transference on the caller's part, and I'm just so pleased you never take any offense at it. And again, it's the most professionally well done journalistic job I think there is.
Well, thank you. That's very nice.
Thanks for the call, Jerry.
Thank you.
Email question from Steve in White Plains, New York. On C-SPAN, why do the cameras never pan the chamber?
First of all, and I almost want to scream it from the mountaintop, we do not control those cameras. We've tried for 25 years to get control of our own cameras, put them in the chamber so you can see what really goes on, but they will not let us do that. We thought maybe when the Republicans took over, because they talked so much about that we could put our own cameras in there, but no deal. Those cameras are controlled by the Speaker of the House. The Speaker can literally say to a director, they don't very often, because they have standard rules, pan the chamber. And they did that back in 1984 when Tip O'Neill was in the chair. That's what's called cam scam, and that's when the Washington Post started writing daily stories about how the Democrats were so irritated with the Republicans and Newt Gingrich and Bob Walker and those folks that they panned the chamber to show that they were talking to an empty room.
Let's get one final call in if we can. Gary's with us from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hey, Neil, great show.
If you could keep it quick, please.
Yeah, real quick, Mr. Lamb, you're very non-confrontational in your interviews, very good at what you do, but have you ever been attacked or mentioned as either a political or ideological enemy of either the right or the left?
Oh, every day. I mean, every day somebody puts on to me something that they are irritated about, no matter what the question is.
Any famous people have attacked you? Any Bill O'Reillys or Rush Limbaughs have gone after you in their shows or anything like that?
I didn't hear this, but several years ago I was told that Mike Savage in San Francisco, who savages everybody, attacked C-SPAN. I'm not sure they attacked me personally, but I never did hear about it. But I know that he is he's fairly mean-spirited with everybody that he talks about.
Gary, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Brian Lamb, our thanks very much for coming in today.
And congratulations again, Neil. 25 long years.
25, it's a good number. Brian Lamb's latest book is Book Notes on American Character, People, Politics, and Conflict in American History. For more information on C-SPAN or excerpts from Brian Lamb's new book, head to our website, www.npr.org. Back after a break, it's NPR News.